Accession number 28353, Real 4.
Peter, we were talking about selecting officers at an early stage. If you want to carry on with that, please do.
Well, I think only to say that it is something which has always been done. At one stage, the service actually had a retired officer whose job it was specifically to keep track of a smallish group of identified officers to make sure that, if you like, that their careers were managed slightly specially. That is not done any longer, probably because our service is smaller now than it once was. Well, obviously it's smaller, and therefore it's easier to do with the formal structures in place. It doesn't need someone to keep a special eye on half a dozen or so youngsters who are showing promise at an early stage. So it still happens, but in a probably a slightly more formal way than it did in the past. But we're now in terms of the career at the stage where I move on from Kemble and the Arrows. I did 6 months with the headquarters of Five Air Portable Brigade at Tidworth, which was quite a useful 6 months, in as much that, again, I learnt a bit more about the way in which the Army operates from their perspective, which was useful subsequently in terms of understanding what drives them on an operational setting, and also from the point of just getting to know a few people in the Army who subsequently I bumped into in later days. As a family, I think it's also right to mention that now, by this time that I moved on, I've got two sons. One was born when we were at Valley, and the second son born whilst we were at Kemble. And so a young family now sort of growing all the time. At the end of the 6 months at Tidworth, I got the job that I really wanted, which was conversion to the Harrier and an appointment as a flight commander on number 3 squadron. Clearly, my decision to leave the Arrows was not an easy decision to take and worried me. Was I doing the right thing? Would it be seen that I had failed in that particular appointment? Well, to an extent I had, in as much that I had had to go and say, I think you should sort of replace me. And therefore, what attitude would the service take on that? The people at the Central Flying School, the commandant of the Central Flying School, who was my most senior reporting officer or chain of command at that stage, was pleasant enough about it. There was a chap called John Severn, but I wasn't sure how much, and I, as far as I remember, I was not invited to go down to Innsworth and be debriefed by the Air Secretaries organisation and say, well, now this is what you can expect. And so when a posting came up to go on to the Harrier course at Wittering with a flight commander appointment to follow, that was a huge encouragement because it was an indication to me that the service was still prepared to value what I was able to do and had not therefore sort of written me off and decided that that I hadn't got a real future either in the air or on the ground. So we went off and converted to the Harrier, which was what I wanted to do. Wonderful aeroplane, although I often think that the most fun aeroplane to fly of my career was the Hunter, because it was a fun aeroplane to fly. It was a relatively simple aeroplane, but just great fun to fly.
You can fly it one hand.
Not necessarily very well one-handed. The Harrier can do so many things and can operate out of so many interesting places, and we'll talk about that over the next sort of a chapter or two. So from a pure point of sort of sheer satisfaction of operating an aeroplane, then the Harrier is for me far superior to anything else that I have ever flown, and the course that I did in the summer of 75 just confirmed that to me. I mean, it was a remarkable aeroplane. Quite demanding, of course, and that is why we still tend to put the people who do best in flying training onto the Harrier, because there are aspects about its flight envelope which can catch you out, more so on the aeroplane in those days than indeed the Harriers of today, which have a greater stability in the air than the early Harriers did. But nevertheless, we still continue to put our best pilots onto the aeroplane. So that, too, was an indication that one's ability was not disregarded.
So in one sense, but well, two very quick things, a simple question, but that suggests then that you started off your flying training as an average student, I think, mm-hmm. was the phrase that you employed. In the business of flying, in the business of actually being in service on the Hunters and elsewhere, your skills had obviously been honed and improved substantially.
Well, I think that's true to say. I suspect that I was seen as an average pilot in the initial stages of training. My flying at Valley on advanced flying training was certainly better than that. And I finished with an above average assessment from Valley. My first tour on 20 Squadron, I finished with an above average assessment. I was certainly, without blowing my trumpet, an above average student at the Central Flying School. My flying as an instructor at Valley was certainly rated between above average and exceptional. So yes, I think I had sort of established that sort of reputation, and certainly by the time I finished as a flight commander on 3 Squadron, then my flying assessment was exceptional as a Harrier pilot. So yes, I think I had sort of moved up the league tables in that way.
And a very quick question was, how old was the Harrier at this stage?
Well, the Harrier had come into service in 1970, so by the time I started my training on the Harrier, it had been in service for 5 years. Some of the sort of the early inadequacies of perhaps of the aeroplane had been modified out and so forth. We were on the cusp of going from the what was known as the Mark I Harrier, which was a single-seat aeroplane, and the Mark II, which was the early trainer aeroplane, the two-seat aeroplane, to a Mark III and a Mark IV, respectively. So we were about to upgrade the aeroplane to a slightly higher level of capability, but still very much aligned to the early Harrier, as opposed to the next model or upgrade, which was much more of an American-produced aeroplane rather than a British-produced aeroplane. The Marks sort of 5, 6 and 7 were very much modelled on the American ideas, although looked vaguely the same, than the Mark 1 and the 3, which were very much a British design.
This is because the US Marines bought it.
Correct. They bought the early Marks, called it slightly different. They called it an AV-8A. Americans then redesigned the aeroplane and produced what they called the AV-8B, which became known as the GR 5, 6 and 7 in our own terminology. Looked the same, but actually there were quite some fundamental differences. It was a much more stable aeroplane, didn't actually go quite as fast because of the bigger engine and bigger intakes that it needed and the drag associated with that. But a significantly different aeroplane, albeit looked vaguely similar.
Thank you.
I'm still, I suppose, at that stage very much a squadron person. I haven't, although I've done a short ground tour with the Army, my experience to date, therefore, for the first nearly 10 years of productive service has been operationally or functionally orientated. Therefore, the day revolves around, if you like, preparing for flying, flying and debriefing afterwards, trying to set high standards to improve on every sortie if possible, not always getting it right, but also doing quite a number of things outside, still playing a reasonable amount of sport, still playing rugby, cricket, squash at sort of representative levels, enjoying probably cricket now more than rugby, playing for Stamford, for Burley Park in Stamford, which was great fun in the summer of 75, and bringing up a young family. I was posted to 3 Squadron at Royal Air Force Wildenrath in Germany, and went out to the squadron in the September of 1975, and Carolyn and the boys joined me sort of a couple of months later, by which time we'd managed to get a quarter and things of that nature. The concept of the Harrier is a unique one within the Air Force in terms of deploying it forward from a main operating base, either to an austere base, an airfield with very few facilities, or in the case of Germany, deploying it forward into urban sites away from any form of airfield. For two reasons, really. First of all, the aircraft could operate in that way, away from any airfield whatsoever, and there was, of course, huge pressure on the limited number of airfields within NATO for reinforcement aircraft to come across from the United States of America and fill up those airfields. So if a force was able to get off an airfield and free that up for somebody else to use, then that was a huge advantage. And that was something that the Harrier could do. So the concept of operations for the Germany Harrier force was to leave Wildenrath, fly forward into the British core area, but relatively close to the front line, and to operate from supermarket sites, garages, where you could store the aircraft inside hangar-type accommodation, storage-type facilities, and operate them off the road strips adjacent to. And we had some 6 or 8 war sites which had been quietly reconnoitred, plans had been made, photographs had been taken, and we knew how we would convert these, knock the doors off storage facilities, supermarkets to put our aeroplanes in, how we build taxiways out to roads, take down, if necessary, light posts, lamp posts, things of that nature, in order to be able to operate off the roads. But we weren't obviously able to practice that, or practice those war sites themselves. We knew where they would be, but we weren't able. And what we did, we replicated those by using farmers' fields and things of that nature. So slightly differently, we had 1 or 2 road strips in the army training area at Senalaga, but by and large, we operated from farmers' fields. People would allow their fields to be used. The Royal Engineers would come and build the hides and the taxiways and the vertical landing pad, and perhaps a metal strip for takeoff if the ground wasn't suitable for just using the grass itself. And 3 times a year we would deploy forward from Wildenrath into the field for 2 weeks at a time, practice that dispersed operational concept, being tasked by our own headquarters in the field, supporting the Army, 1st British Corps, in its area of operation for 2 weeks, and then we'd go back to Wildenrath, clean the aeroplanes and the mud and things of that nature off everything, then sort of work up towards the next deployment. It was a viable concept of operations, but it was a pretty expensive concept of operations because of the logistic support required. The huge number of vehicles that were tied into deploying forward with all the kit, but mainly all the fuel that had to go into the field, all the spare support and things of that nature. So to deploy some 36 or so airplanes into the field, we had something like 1,500 prime moving vehicles to get us all into the field. So it was a very expensive concept. It required army signallers, army sappers, as well as our own second line people, and so forth to support us in the field. So each site of about six aeroplanes actually directly involved on the site were probably 120 or so people, plus more held centrally who could come and support if required. And I think that was the reason why, frankly, we did not manage to sell the aeroplane to any other NATO air forces. They could see the sheer logistics support costs of this concept of operations. And also, I think we had named the aeroplane the Jump Jet, or the press had named the aeroplane the Jump Jet, and huge emphasis was put on vertical takeoff by the press and the media, rather than short takeoff and vertical landing. Shots were seen of this aircraft getting airborne out of a wood, you know, miles from anywhere, vertically. What people didn't say is, but it can't carry anything when it's doing that, so it hasn't actually got a function or a purpose. This is, a display manoeuvre only, to all intents and purposes. What you ought to do is you ought to operate the aircraft as a short takeoff vertical landing, and if you don't want to deploy it into the field, as we have done, into supermarket sites and so forth, then operate it from a fixed base, but disperse it around that base, and no matter what the enemy does to the airfield, there will always be some space and enough taxiway and strip for you to be able to operate the aeroplane. But you don't then need these 1,500 vehicles to deploy the force forward. And I think if we had pushed that as the concept of operations, then we would have actually sold the aircraft to other NATO air forces. As it was, we persevered with it, but others, I think, more competent than I, will say that it actually got a fairly close-run thing, that the force nearly jeopardised itself, firstly because of the expense and the cost, secondly because we lost a lot of aeroplanes in the early days through accidents, lost a lot of aeroplanes, people mishandling the aircraft and crashing. I mean, we did lose a lot of Harriers, and I think that undermined some confidence back in London, and also the cost was being highlighted as being a very expensive way to operate a relatively small force of aircraft. But fortunately, none of those things came to pass, and I did just over 3 years in Germany as a flight commander on the aeroplane. And I'm coming back to the point where I was talking earlier about the leadership aspects for a relatively junior, albeit now a sort of a squadron leader of some 2 years or so seniority, was this aspect of being a site commander, because each of the squadrons had a small squadron's two sites, then when we went to two big squadrons as opposed to three small squadrons, three sites. But as a squadron leader, you actually commanded one of those field sites, because the boss and one flight commander would command one, and the other flight commander would command the other site. And that experience of commanding a small airfield, not out of sight and out of mind, but nearly so, with all of those aspects, whether it's air traffic control, Royal Engineers, sappers, signalers, your own engineers, your own cooks, bottle washers, and so forth, is a tremendous responsibility and experience for a chap aged sort of 20, 29, 30, something of that nature. And unless you're in the Harrier force, or unless you're in the support helicopter force, something at that stage which you're highly, those days were highly unlikely to have had that experience. More opportunity these days with expeditionary air operations, deployments to Ali Al Salam and other places in the Middle East, but at that stage, unique to the Harrier and the support helicopter force. At the same time, the fact that you were the site commander, and frankly your job was to run that small forward airfield, meant that you were more use doing that than you were in the air as a combat pilot. And I certainly had come to the conclusion that if we ever deployed into those sites for real, then the likelihood was that I would do very little operational flying from that site that the vast majority of my time and focus would be spent commanding the site and making sure that it was fit to fight and as operationally effective as possible, and would not therefore lead in the air. And this has a direct relationship to what then happened in 1982, because that actually turned out to be different. We'll come to that in a moment.
So who would lead your aircraft in the air whilst as you're more used as a site commander on the ground?
Predominantly the senior flight lieutenants on the flight. So my sort of deputy flight commander, although there may have been times when I would say, look, you know, certainly on training exercises, I would say, look, I've done the site commander job now, you know, from dawn until 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm only going to fly for a couple of sorties this afternoon, so you can command the site. Whether I would have done that in war, I don't know. I suspect that the preoccupation of site commandering with real bombs dropping and things of that nature would have meant that I probably would not. I would have felt that my job was on the ground commanding the site and looking after that. And so the formation leaders would have been the senior flight lieutenants on the squadron or on the flight.
Thank you. And just one quick thing about jump jets and taking off from forest clearings. Presumably the reason I didn't know that the aircraft could not take off vertically from a forest clearing bombed up, so to speak, it was only capable of taking itself off with a full load of fuel.
Maybe not even a full load of fuel, depending on the temperature of the day and the pressure and things of that nature. But certainly, conceivably, it could get airborne with a couple of rocket pods on and almost no fuel, or a reasonable amount of fuel, but no weapons. But it wasn't really an operational concept. You needed a takeoff run of 300 or 400 metres, something of that nature, to get airborne with a full warload. But you could then come back and land vertically without too much,
because you're much lighter,
having expended the weapons and
some fuel.
And quite a lot of fuel. Yes. Yeah. So I think we should have really sort of campaigned the aeroplane as a STOVL. And that's the way we approach it these days: short takeoff and vertical landing on a V-stall aeroplane.
Right, thank you.
What else went on during my time? Because obviously the nature of a flight commander's job is similar to many other jobs. As I say, that our war role was this dispersed operations close to the front line. Three Squadron, whilst I was on it, also had the responsibility of trying to work up a night capability. In those days, we did not have night vision goggles, as the crews of fast jet as well as support helicopters operate with today, and therefore operating out of a dispersed location at night was very difficult and required a lot of practice and a fairly careful approach to it as well, because unless one looked at it very carefully, you could certainly get into a lot of difficulty and a lot of trouble. And Three Squadron was tasked with working up a night capability, which we did predominantly on the main airfield. And by this time, the squadrons had moved forward to Gütersloh rather than Wildenrath. So Gütersloh was a better place to have as a main operating base, albeit we still deployed forward for that for our exercises and would have done for war. But what we did for the night capability is that we initially just did it from the runway but without lights. Then we would got the sappers to put a metal strip down just off the runway, and we'd taxi out onto the metal strip and use that with markers which were luminous, so that there was some ability to keep a straight line. And similarly for landing, there would either be a few glim lamps for markers or these luminous strips that we could use. But basically we worked out very gently off the main runway without lights to using a strip with some lighting and markers, and then into vertical landings. And because I was the not the squadron qualified flying instructor, but I did have an instructional qualification on the aeroplane, I did most of the the sort of the oversight and initial dual checking of people to allow them to do this night flying, and that was therefore a particular responsibility that I had during the 3 years, and was something that to be carried out successfully. And by the time I left, the squadron was reasonably competent and could certainly have deployed from Goodislow into the field by night, or redeployed by night out of the field and into another field site. I'm not sure that we had got to the point that we could have actually carried out combat operations at night, but we'd certainly got to the point that we could deploy and redeploy, and that was an advance on what had been possible previously. The second thing which sort of came my way in terms of responsibility, if you like, was that I led the first Germany manned detachment to Belize. Belize was an area of operation which had been covered by number one squadron out of Wittering for some years, really since 1975, when they deployed to Belize to help suppress a Guatemalan threat to the colony. One squadron had been manning that as a detachment, not permanently, but they'd done it for a while, come out and had to go back in again. But the demands of that detachment had really started to tear the one squadron apart, in as much that people were spending so much time there that the whole squadron was breaking up. They never spent any time at home together, they never worked up any proper capability. And so the Air Force, rightly in my view, decided that the whole of the Harrier force should bear this particular burden. And therefore, from about July, August of 1978, it was decided that Germany would pick up a three-year period when they would man it in its entirety, and allow one squadron to regenerate as a viable organisation, work up their own proper UK and NATO capability, and actually have a break out of Belize. And so I was chosen to lead the first of the RAF Germany detachments to Belize, which I did in the months of sort of August, September, October of 78. And this was really, if you like, from my perspective, the most operationally effective way of operating the aeroplane. We operated out of Belize International Airfield, but they had built hide areas off dispersed taxiways away from the main runway. And although there was no great threat to Belize Airport at that stage, again, you could see how the airplane could be operated somewhere from that airfield, regardless of what was done to it. And we had some six aircraft out there, and eight pilots, and we operated from a dispersed posture, but on a main operating base for 3 months. And it was good, it was satisfying. Again, it was another opportunity to command a semi-independent organisation at the rank of squadron leader, with your own airmen, own administrative support, and so forth, making your own decisions as someone who wasn't, again, totally out of sight and out of mind, but nevertheless running a semi-independent organisation. And so from that perspective, it was a good experience. I enjoyed 3 months in Belize. It was quite a nice place to be. There wasn't much of a threat, frankly, against us, and therefore we enjoyed the flying and enjoyed playing in Belize and spending the weekends out on the quays, snorkeling and eating lobster. So it really wasn't a bad way to finish what had been quite a busy tour. And really, very soon after I came back from that particular detachment, I finished my flight commander tour and returned to the United Kingdom. Have I got any other thoughts about my time as a flight commander and the role of a Harrier? No, I don't think so at this stage. As I say, it was clearly a very challenging but rewarding aeroplane to fly. I did enjoy operating a fairly sophisticated aircraft out of very unsophisticated surroundings. I mean, one or two deployments, you know, literally operating, going over one site that we operated out just north of Larbrook, where we
and the takeoff run had to clear a hedge. We took down a bit of the hedge because it was really quite close to the end of the strip, and you would actually get, the road was slightly raised from the field, so the road was probably sort of 2.5 feet above the field level. Well, we were clearing the road by perhaps 2 or 3 feet, going over the top of it, so they closed the road, so the road was out of action. But we were flying the aeroplane very close to the limit of the aeroplane, and that too was demanding and rewarding. So to operate an aircraft as sophisticated as the Harrier out of those sort of stuff, great fun. And again, you know, the aeroplane get bogged down in the mud from time to time, you have to pull it out with a tractor and all of the, and to me that's what in many ways flying is all about. It is actually sort of making interesting decisions on the hoof, how to get the job done, and having to improvise sometimes to get the job done, and so that it was a great experience, much enjoyed. But now came my first ground tour, because sooner or later it had to be done. I had no choice. I